How y'all doing today? How y'all doing today? And some of you are like, I'm not great. Can you just leave me alone? My introvert's like, really? You'll notice I like audience participation. And so this sermon includes a couple of points where I'll need your input. So I invite you to be ready for that moment when it comes. So in July, one of our sibling congregations at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in New Orleans experienced a protest during a pastoral prayer by an organization called Operation Save America. Operation Save America had descended on the New Orleans area for a week to engage an intense effort to close abortion clinics within the city. On this particular Sunday morning, Reverend Deanna Vandiver was in the middle of leading the congregation in a prayer meditation, kind of quiet and peaceful time, when members of the OSA stood up and began exhorting their opinions about abortion, offering materials that depicted very clear images of aborted fetuses, thrusting them in the hands of the group of high schoolers visiting from out of state that day. Meanwhile, outside of the building, other protesters were holding up posters of aborted fetuses against the windows of the religious education classrooms where the children were gathered for their classes. Let me ask you this question. What would you personally have done in this situation? And what would we do here if this were to occur during one of our worship services? What the congregation in New Orleans did was dig deep into their religious values and respond with compassion, patience, and boundaries. They strive for relationship where the theological difference was a barrier. But what is most interesting is that while this was a traumatic event for many, relationship won the day. They stayed in relationship with the protesters who showed up in their pews. The minister invited the OSA protesters to stay in the sanctuary or to leave. If they chose to stay, they needed to stay quietly. Some acknowledged that they could not stay quietly, so they agreed to leave the room. And about five others agreed to stay silently and be in the service. It had just happened that there was a group of high school age youth from the College of Social Justice participating in a justice and leadership training, and they were in the congregation that day and found they had an immediate use for the skills they had learned that week. They sang hymns about the love during the loudest part of the protest of the people there gathered, and the congregation modeled with them disagreeing compassionately and respectfully. Even as they might be yelled at, they responded with presence and with listening ears. At the same time, they did not accept this behavior as welcome in their community. The thing about relationship is that it requires communication and listening. Many of the protesters had not come to listen. They had come to share their creed, but not to be present to relationship. Those who could not comply, of course, were asked to leave the space. Children in the building were moved to an inner classroom where there were no windows. And with the support of the police, who were able to show up thanks to a second minister who just happened to be in the audience that day, they moved the protesters off of the property onto the sidewalk where they continued their protest. After worship was over, Reverend Vandiver called the local Planned Parenthood, which they had a relationship, and Planned Parenthood sent the volunteers who often walk women safely into clinics to the church to help our members safely leave their church. That week, the congregation worked with area organizations to send a message of love and community that was counter to the OSA protests in New Orleans. All in all, given the situation, I would say the congregation handled things pretty darn well. Would you? Can you imagine that happening here? I can imagine it happening here. Can you imagine responding to it that well? I'm not sure if I could do it. It would take a lot of our presence and a lot of our patience. This is not to say that it was easy, and certainly the minister and the congregation's training and skill played a part. As a covenantal faith, we have long since had a focus on relationship over and above theology. Theology has been important from our formation, but we have long been more about deeds than creeds, even going back to our Puritan days in the 1600s. The reading this morning from a modern reflection on a historical document called the Cambridge Platform, that document set forth our polity, how we would be as a denomination, our way of organizing. How churches choose to organize says a lot about what they believe as a religious community. In our case, this document was written in response to another platform written in England. That platform dictated that all churches were set up under the governance of England and the monarchy, and formalized a hierarchy of sorts in which people could come in top down and tell congregations what to do. The Cambridge platform, on the other hand, stated clearly what the Puritans had long believed, that churches are the responsibility of the people in the pews, the community there gathered. Emphasis was placed on personal responsibility to your church community and the importance of lay leaders to the everyday implementation of church life. At that time, ministers were expected to study and to preach, and that was it. Can you imagine that? I can't. Just to study and to preach. And frequently would preach as often as 20 times a week. I also can't imagine that. Lay leaders handled everything else. These communities believed that they were creating heavenly communities here on earth in anticipation of the world's end. They believed, as it stated in the Pauline letters, that it was their job to create heaven here on earth, to act as if it already existed, so when the end times came, they were ready for it. They were to make these communities holy now and not after death. Even today, that informs the theologies and philosophies of Unitarian Universalists. You may or may not believe in an afterlife. Anybody willing to share? Do you believe in an afterlife? Anyone willing to? Some of you may or may not. Yes, some yes. Okay. And some do not. But we all believe in the importance of doing good work in the here and now, in this life. For justice should not be deferred to heaven, to beyond. Justice is here and now. The phrase "relationships trump theology" comes from a sermon at our National Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in Rhode Island this past June. Next Sunday, the entirety of that sermon will be shown here, and you'll have an opportunity to listen to all the many things that were spoken in that sermon. But I want to expound on one simple concept from that sermon. One of our military chaplains, Reverend Rebecca Montgomery, shares in her sermon her experiences as a military chaplain in Afghanistan, often being the first woman soldier that people had seen, let alone the first woman mullah, as they like to call her, in that region, who often also drove the Humvee because she wasn't allowed to carry a weapon, so she would do the driving. So she shattered many illusions as a chaplain in the military in many different ways. At one point, she explains that one of the most important things that we as Unitarian Universalists bring to the table is the importance of relationship over belief, that we need not think alike to love alike. We as a religion encompass people of a wide array of theologies, philosophies, and ontologies. In fact, we somewhat rely on differences between individuals as one of our key values of life. As Reverend Judith Walker Riggs put it, "How welcoming is your Unitarian Universalist Church if there is not something happening that you do not approve of?" In other words, if you like everything going on, we're probably not being a good Unitarian Universalist Church because we're not diverse enough yet. That said, we are not called to be unkind or spiteful or highly critical. And that can be a difficult line to walk at times. To be highly disagreeing with someone and to be kind, I've certainly had those moments. I'm sure you have too. This brings us back to that language of covenant. As a covenantal faith, we rely on the agreements that we make amongst one another about how we will be as a community. Congregations and groups that fail to name these expectations often find themselves in heightened church conflict or discomfort when these expectations are not stated or even agreed upon. In some ways, this idea of being covenantal is radical now, even as it was 400 years ago. Why? Because that is not our society's norm, is it? How do we have norms in diverse communities that are not based on the cultural norms of the privileged community that has been always in charge? It's not an easy thing to do. Recently, we've seen this example in multiple spades. With the events in Ferguson, Missouri, Beaver Creek, Ohio, Sanford, Florida, Oakland, California, and on and on, we have had some really open and honest conversations about race. What is truly fascinating is the tendency for people from privileged communities, those who have the power, whether they want it or not, to deny the lived experiences of those who are marginalized. One woman shared her realization that once a friend questions whether her experience as an African-American woman is real or not, that she immediately moves them into the acquaintance category, whether they talk about it or not. How can she be friends with someone who does not trust her experience? Her experience of receiving tickets unfairly, of being followed in stores, or needing to pay attention to what clothes she wears so that she's not hassled. And unfortunately, this is all too common. I personally have experienced discrimination and distrust at the hands of police as a transgender person. I, like many gay, lesbian, transgender, and queer individuals, make decisions about my day based on whether I want to deal with discrimination or not. Planning when to drink water so that you do not need to go to a bathroom before you are actually near enough to one that is safe to use. Refusing to go out at certain times of day. Avoiding towns where cops are notoriously problematic, etc. If you've not had those experiences of needing to plan your life around the institutions that privilege you, it can be hard to hear someone share those experiences and hear them without trying to say, but, or, wait, did you think of this? To just sit and listen is one of the key skills of a covenantal faith, to let people's truth be true without trying to fix it or make anybody feel better. That's not an easy one. And goodness knows our society fails at that one spectacularly. Perhaps these differences are most apparent when people come from other countries to interact in our systems of oppression. A Catholic priest friend of mine from Kenya once shared how angry and embarrassed he was of being pulled over in a predominantly white major Midwestern city when he was driving an older parishioner home. She was sick. She was in her 80s and really struggling and just did not feel comfortable driving home on the icy roads. And so she asked him if he would give her a ride home. They were stopped by an officer who repeatedly asked him whether this was his car. It was. What he was doing there on that street at that particular time. And he asked the woman over and over again if she was safe, if she needed help, if he was holding her against her will. Eventually, the officer let him go. But my friend commented that never in his life had he experienced such intense and frequent racism as he did in the United States. This is a Catholic priest. The truth is that our society does not do healthy relationship between our differences very well. This means that our tendency to focus on covenant and relationship is truly a revolutionary and prophetic act. And one that requires our vigilance and our patience and our practice. Practicing this prophetic witness begins with us here in the pews. Begins with us in our relationships and our families and with our friends. The differences between another here are all so varied that it can be complicated to navigate how to be in relationship because we do not all speak the same cultural languages. Someone sneezes. What's the appropriate response? Gesundheit. What else? Bless you. Any others? Yeah, I don't know. That's very, I'm not sure what I'll do with that. Okay. In Arizona and much of the Southwest, The majority of people say salud, no matter what country or culture they are from. Bless their heart in the South is an insult. Bless their heart in the East is an actual blessing. Here in the Midwest, it depends on who you're talking to. But let's take this up a notch for a moment. I'm going to ask you a series of questions based on Margaret Anderson's work, and she does consensus building training, and she has a you can't lose quiz that she gives, and we're just going to do three of the examples from her quiz. This is a forced choice exercise, which I know Unitarian Universalists love. The thing is to pick the one you think is the right and normal one. And if you're the kind of person who really struggles with that right and normal, what is most comfortable for you? What is familiar to you? Okay? So this is the first one. Two examples. You decide which one is normal or sounds better to you. Would you make 10 copies of this? Could you make 10 copies of this? Just pick one. I'll say it again. Would you make 10 copies of this? Could you make 10 copies of this? You got it? Part two. A man and yourself are assigned to work on a project in two parts. You would really like to work on part one. When you meet with him, he says, I want to work on part one, so you take part two. You say, one of three responses. A, hey, you're not my boss. You know who you are. No, I want to do part one. Or three, I'd sort of like to do part one. Read that one more time. Pick the one that's most comfortable to you. A man and yourself are assigned to work on a project in two parts. You would really like to work on part one. When you meet with him, he says, I want to work on part one. So you take part two. You say either A, hey, you're not my boss. B, no, I want to do part one. Or C, I'd sort of like to do part one. Pick the one that's most comfortable and the most honest, okay? I know there's probably one you wish you did. That's not the one to pick, the one you would actually do. And question three. You're eating dinner with your friend Roger. The butter is on the table next to you, but too far for Roger to reach. He says, would you like some butter? Do you A, say yes, thank you, and take some butter? B, say no, thank you, and continue eating? Or C, pass the butter to Roger saying, please help yourself. And again, pick the one you know you would actually do. You're eating dinner with your friend Roger. The butter is on the table next to you, but too far for Roger to reach. He says, would you like some butter? Do you A, say yes, thank you, and take some butter? B, say no, thank you, and continue eating? Or C, pass the butter to Roger saying, please help yourself. You got it? Going back to the first question, you walk into the fellowship's office and someone asks, either A, would you make 10 copies of this? Or B, could you make 10 copies of this? How many would prefer A? Raise your hand. And how many would prefer B? It's about half and half, right? I apologize. The first two times I read it exactly the same, that third time I did it differently. I apologize.
The way you said it the first time was, would you like to make 10 copies?
Ah. Okay. It's actually, would you make 10 copies of this or could you make 10 copies of this? The point being, some people hear, would you make 10 copies of this as a command and not a request? How many people might think that's a command and not a request? Could you make 10 copies of this could be perceived as being polite. It also could be perceived as you're not capable, or they're not sure if you're capable. How many of you might think that? All right.
I thought that the first time I heard it, and the second time I heard it, I thought, could as in, do you have the time to make the
time? Right. So and different parts of the country, there's different norms. If I said, would you make 10 copies of this in Alabama, I would have been presumed rude. I do the same thing in Arizona, that would have been the preferred, saying could you would have been presuming ability. Just depends on where you live, depends on how you grew up, right? Okay. A man and yourself are assigned to work on a project in two parts. You would really like to work on part one, and when you meet him, I want to work on part one, so you take part two. you say, how many of you would say, hey, you're not my boss? Is Sandra in here? I'm like, where's Sandra? No? Curious. Okay, Lane is very clear. All right. B, no, I want to do part one. How many would say that? Mm-hmm. How many of you would say, I'd sort of like to do part one? Okay, the majority. Very Midwestern, by the way. The East Coast, C, would totally fail. Yeah. Okay. But again, you'll notice different answers and different preferences. And that's the thing to notice, is even in this community, these little things, we have different ways of perceiving the words. So when it comes to massive cultural differences, how hard is it to navigate being in a healthy, confident relationship? The final one. You're eating dinner with your friend Roger. The butter is on the table next to you, but too far for Roger to reach. He says, would you like some butter? How many of you said, A, yes, thank you, and took some butter? Being honest, I would have done that. Okay. B, no, thank you, and continue eating. Okay. And C, pass the butter to Roger saying, please help yourself. A and C. How would that sound? Yes, thank you. Would you like some? Yeah. Okay. Interestingly, if you say anything other than C in Alabama, ooh, I had a rudeness. In fact, when I asked the first two, the congregation laughed, and we didn't even really get past the question, right? You know, because if somebody asks that, it's assumed that they're asking for butter. Whereas where I grew up, if you didn't ask, you know, say, please pass me the butter, you weren't getting it. Okay. So we have all kinds of differences in our communities based on the family we were raised in, the cultures we grew up in, and we have different ways of perceiving words and how we understand them, and that's when we all speak English. Right? So today, and in the next few weeks, our children and youth will be creating covenants in their classrooms. So often our children lead the way for our faith. And so often they have to teach their teachers that covenants are not rules. They are promises. You notice that the language, they are promises. The word covenant is based on a legal concept. When you make a covenant, it's assumed that you're making a legal promise to a person. How many people have had that understanding of the word covenant? It's a legal promise. I'm sure some of our lawyers have. You notice, though, that the language as we use it in our church is not law-based. It's promise-based. It is a statement of how we're going to be together, how we want the church to be together. Covenants are active. They're short. They're easy to understand. And when they are at their best, everyone knows what it is. For Unitarian Universalists, here are some basic assumptions we have about covenants. First, it is created jointly by the community that agrees to follow them, or at least everybody that can show up on that day. It is reviewed regularly to make sure that it is still current. For example, one of the seminaries in the United States found that they had a covenant for their community, and as they had an increasing number of African Americans, they realized they had to change the language, because being kind and respectful was perceived as being calm and patient. And in African American communities, being loud and whatever is normal, is how you communicate. It is being kind. To many of their white compatriots, it was perceived as being angry, which they were not. They were just being loud and rambunctious and not angry at all. So they had to change the covenant to meet the needs of the community. The most important thing to know about a covenant is it will be broken. You will break it. I will break it. We will break it. Covenants are meant to be broken, not because we are willfully trying to go out, let me see what most creative way I can not use an I statement today. It's about trying to be in a healthy relationship and knowing we struggle because we're human. And when the covenant is broken, that the response is not punitive, that instead it's about reconciliation. So if I say something that is hurtful to Lane, Lane and I will sit down and have a conversation. And if it's something that requires my apology, great. And if Lane feels like there needs to be something more done, we'll work on that. But it's reconciling, not somebody coming in and saying, you have to leave the church for 2 weeks because you were mean. You know, we're not going to do that. I want to close with that last concept. And Lane, thank you for letting me pick on you. Covenants are not hard rules that require some form of retribution and atonement. That is one of the many ways in which Unitarian Universalism is unique. We aren't about judging or damning or putting up walls, at least last I checked. Anybody pro-damning? No? Okay. We are about setting healthy boundaries. What might this look like? There was a congregation that had a covenant in place, as well as a right relationship team that helped members and friends and staff to respond to particularly difficult breaches of the covenant. A man had slapped a woman on the bottom. As you might imagine, the woman was highly offended. The man, and this was about 10 years ago, was in his 80s and grew up in a world where hitting someone on the ass was a compliment, at least in his mind. And the man refused to apologize, thinking that what he had done was not so egregious. As you might imagine, things escalated. Now, in a punitive system, there might have been a hard rule that said, you can't come back, or you have to do certain things before you can come back, and no conversation had. In a reconciling system, the parties are encouraged to speak with each other, to set agreements about how they will be in the future, and to set boundaries. In this instance, conversations were had between the relevant parties. The man agreed to apologize. He also understood that future actions like this would result in him being asked to leave the community for a period of time. One interesting thing about covenants is that there is an avenue for asking people to leave the church for a while and always an avenue for return. We do not excommunicate people, but we also don't let people hang out and just be mean. That's not okay. I think sometimes we make the mistake that we think being welcoming means we're going to put up with anything, and that's not healthy. We set boundaries, and we say no when we need to say no, and we say yes when we can say yes. So, for example, a person might be asked to take a class on anger management or preventing sexual harassment, having an accountability partner once they return, or simply refraining from having a similar breach in the future. There are many ways in which we can reconcile and heal those things where people feel assured. In other words, actions have consequences, right? We are about relationship with and among and not power over. The promises we make to each other are mutual, and those who chose to come into this community would have to agree to those promises in order to stay. It is an active and a dynamic system that models our greater society how to be imperfect and whole all at once. How would things have been done differently in Ferguson if this had been the model? How did First Unitarian Universalist New Orleans benefit from the awareness of such practices? Relationship trumps theology. This is a call for us to be in healthy relationship, especially when it isn't easy. When we are faced with a protester telling us we are going to hell in our pews, when we say something or do something racist or classist or homophobic or ageist, whether we meant to or not, and we all have and will. What we are called to is to foster healthy relationship with healthy boundaries. And it is a lifelong process. There is not some check-it-off list goal involved at the end. I'm sorry to my J's and my A-types. There is not some checklist for achievement. Relationship trumps theology. This is a call to celebrate difference and diversity, to embrace beauty and struggle of a world where we cannot even agree on how to ask for the butter. It is a call to strive for a healthy world transformed by our care. A call to build bridges and live into love and grace. And so I close by reading again the words from Alice Blair Wesley. But if one does not speak of the covenant that constitutes the community as a church, the promise that all are cordially invited to enter, then what does one say is the basis for the liberal church? Long experience teaches us that it cannot be a creed. I hope the day comes when many can explain ours is a covenantal church. We join by promising one another that we will be a beloved community, meeting together often to find the ways of love as best we can see to do. We have found there is always more to learn about how love really works and could work in our lives and in the world. May it be so.